Okay, I'm laughing already. I'm not sure if we can do this next hour, folks, but we got to do it. This is going to be probably the most fun I've had in a long time. I know that. You all know that I am, as a musician, I love being a chameleon, you know, especially with classical music and jazz and funk and just the history of American music. The man sitting across the table from me right now is the master of that. And he's going to take us on a journey through his life and what it is to be a real musician. And I wish I'd actually start by playing Billie Jean, Michael Jackson. Now, you play drums on that.
I play drums on Billie Jean.
Oh, my goodness. That's like defining a whole couple decades in America. Ladies and gentlemen, Ndugu Chancellor. You know, we got to start with Billie Jean. And okay, folks, you know, I know this is a jazz show. Just listen. It's going to be okay. Talk about Billie Jean and like when you got the call from Quincy.
Quincy Jones.
Yeah.
Well, see, that's the jazz connection. In recording with Quincy, mm-hmm. you know, I ended up recording a number of diverse projects. I worked on Frank Sinatra. I worked on Donna Summer, George Benson.
Lady in My Life.
Yes.
No, L.A. is My Lady.
No, L.A. is My Lady.
Yeah, I like that project. Yeah.
And that was a live date done in New York and in Los Angeles
exactly.
with some of the most premier jazz players around then.
Right.
Part of Quincy's signature was that he always incorporated a jazz element in his productions. You know, most people don't realize that Jimmy Smith, the organist, is playing organ solo on Bad.
That's right.
Aha.
That's
aha.
Right.
So this whole jazz thing
yeah.
and the jazz musician was around all of these pop records from the history of the music period.
That's right.
So with Quincy, whatever project he took on, he had a crew of musicians that he used, and I happened to be one in the crew. So he used me on Michael Jackson, Donna Summer, George Benson, James Ingram, Patty Austin, mm-hmm. Michael McDonald, James Ingram, all of these projects. And we ended up doing Thriller and Bad.
Mm-hmm.
So Billie Jean just happened to come as a result of that.
Awesome. Oh, my God. And that defines, again, you know, just think of how many drummers, you know, young drummers who started with that. And influence them. Unbelievable. Oh, I was listening to Quincy Jones, the dude. I think it's I Know Carita.
Yes.
And I think it's Herbie Hancock playing piano. Or
that's a possibility.
But it's so funky busy. That
yeah.
Not in the terms of just laying a chord and laying a groove. I mean, it's all over the place. But that's, I think that's definitely the jazz influence. So let's go back to your early beginnings. Why drums? How'd you get started in it?
You'll appreciate this story.
Okay.
This is a very interesting story. I was born in Shreveport, Louisiana.
Okay.
Shreveport, Louisiana has nothing to do with the music of New Orleans.
And that you're on the northern side?
I'm on the northern side, right next to Arkansas and Texas. They call that area the Arklatex.
Yes.
Because it's right on the border of all three.
Right.
It's a farming town.
Mm-hmm.
Cotton, wood. Logging, Puckwood, we called it Puckwood.
Yeah.
So I never really got exposed to a lot of music.
Okay.
But at 6 years old, I would go in the backyard, and I made me a drum out of a coffee can and an oatmeal box. And I tied the drum around my neck, got two branches off the tree, wow. and just started beating on things. Well, my family moved to California when I was 8, mm-hmm. and I went to elementary school, and I told the teacher, I said, I want to play the drums. And the teacher said, you have the lips and the arms to play the trombone.
They told me tuba. Anyway.
Now, you know all the trombone jokes that exist.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you'll never see a trombonist in a Porsche. What does a trombone player say when he comes to your door? Pizza. You know, you hear all these jokes. Or well, they weren't in existence then.
Do you want fries with that? I know.
But I did not want to play any other instrument except the drums.
Awesome.
So when she told me I had to play trombone, I said, well, then I won't play. Mm. So for 7 years, I didn't play any instruments.
You're kidding.
No. When you have this burning urge mm-hmm. that just came through you, that was just like heaven sent, right. You are a drummer. You know, I had my calling then. It's like when a minister gets his calling. Mm-hmm. I had my calling. My calling said, you are a drummer. I'm saying, what's a drummer? Well, you'll find out. Just follow the word.
There you go.
So when I got to junior high school, I tried it again. Mm-hmm. I walked in the room because now, in the interim, I'm the steak knife drummer. Whenever I'm washing dishes at home, I got the steak knives going. So I got to junior high school, and I went in, and I said, I want to play the drums. And the teacher said, fine. Now, little did he know that I had this energetic, hyperactive thing about playing drums that I was obsessed.
Nice.
And I changed my whole educational programming once I was able to play the drum. Because I was going to school for math then. I was great at math. And I said, well, you know, I could be a computer programmer. Mm-hmm. But then when I picked up the drumsticks, there went computer programming.
Wow.
So I started playing in junior high school. Mm-hmm. And I really kind of made up for all the lost time because I sacrificed Little League. Though I love baseball, I sacrificed Little League. Never did shoot a basketball. So that became my passion. Yeah. And that really became my direction. So by the time I was in high school, I was slowly starting to get decent enough to play around town.
And this is in L.A.?
In L.A.
Oh, what a, wow.
Now, I was fortunate in L.A. that by the time I got to high school, we had guys like Nelson Riddle and Gerald Wilson coming over to the school, mentoring and giving us workshops. So I had goals and aspirations of what
yes,
to do.
That's important.
These things were priming me for the studio scene, the big band scene, the jazz scene, and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the Latin scene, because in high school, I started working with Willie Bobo.
Oh, so, you're kidding me.
You know, that's the transition from playing just drums to drums and timbales and percussion.
Yes.
So it all started there.
Mm-hmm. And that's a testimony to what's needed today.
Most definitely, yeah. Because I can't lie, I was from a very impoverished family. My father left when I was 13. As soon as I decided I wanted to play the drums, he left.
Oh, no.
That, yeah,
it's not connected, though.
Yeah. So, you know, we were from a basic family, mm-hmm. you know. But the great thing about that is there was a hunger to better yourself and find your niche and your goal. So mm-hmm. that's what I did.
Awesome. So did you bypass college or was college?
No, I went to college. Mm-hmm. I went to college on a scholarship. That's the only way I could go. Mm-hmm. And I went to Cal State Dominguez Hills, which was, I went to a brand new high school and I went to a brand new college.
Very
so
nice.
There were a lot of pioneering going on. Right. My class was the first class to do 3 years in this brand new high school. Mm-hmm. And then I went to a brand new college and there wasn't a jazz program there. So I was a music ed major.
So okay.
I did that and played on the weekends and did all that. And things just started to come together.
That's awesome. Wow. In terms of your first, you mentioned Willie Bobo. What were some of your other early music experiences?
Well, there were a couple. Right after high school, in that summer, that was the summer of enlightenment. Mm-hmm. Because 2 weeks after I got out of high school, I worked with Gerald Wilson Big Band at Shelley's Manhole. Mm. And from there, Shelley Mann took me under his wings
mm-hmm.
and just mentored me and groomed me and connected me with a number of acts. From being mentored by Shelley, I worked with James Moody and Thelonious Monk and Eddie Harris and Donald Byrd, just all the acts that came through Shelley's Manhole, including Freddie Hubbard. And I did this gig with Gerald Wilson, and all the musicians from L.A. started coming by, and they're like, who's this young drummer playing in this band? Because I replaced Styx Hooper, who was my mentor.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Yeah, well, Styx and I have a long history, because he was like the first drummer that took interest in me and started to teach me and show me the ropes and everything.
And Styx Hooper from the Crusaders.
From the Crusaders.
Oh, my goodness.
So I worked with Gerald, and then all of a sudden, Herbie Hancock had come to my high school while I was there, and he needed a bass player and a drummer to play during the assembly. So myself and the bassist at school, who ended up playing with the Craig Huntley Trio in Vegas, we played with Herbie. So all of a sudden, I get this call from Herbie, Tootie Heath had left the band, and he said, well, I'm coming out to L.A. to play the Forum, and we're opening for the Iron Butterfly. Oh. We don't have time to rehearse, but pick me up at the airport, and we'll talk about the music in the car, and we'll play this gig. So we played the Forum, which was the big arena at that time.
That's right.
Where the Lakers and all the teams played. We opened for the Iron Butterfly, because during those days, you know, they had all of these psychedelic combinations.
Right.
You know, Charles Lloyd and Jimi Hendrix, you know, Can Heat and Miles Davis, or anything like that. It had all of these weird combinations. So we did that gig. So Herbie Hancock asked me to join the band. But that was before I had enrolled in college. So I said, Herbie, I got to go to college. I have a scholarship. And I would break my mom's heart if I didn't go to college. So I said, I can't join the band. So he said, okay, if we do another album, we'll have two drummers. That's so that's true. How the album In Mwadishi came about with me playing on it.
Yeah.
You know, he kept to his word, and we had two drummers on the album. He flew me up to San Francisco, and we recorded that album during that same period. So I was in college then. And then my first gig where I traveled, because at that point I had never been on an airplane.
Is that right?
I got a gig with Hugh Masekela in the Union of South Africa.
Oh, man.
So they were all managed and incorporated with the Crusaders. So I was right at home. I had Styx to show me the ropes, and we would open for them. So it was Leta Mbulu, Kaifa Semenya, Hugh Masekela, and Jonas Kwangwa in the front line. Yeah. And we had a band with Hugh Masekela, and we started traveling. And that was where my traveling experience came from.
That's amazing. And, you know, the thing to recognize is the fact that it's not just about the recording, it's not just about the live gigs, it's the time that you spent off the bandstand or out of the studio with these incredible minds.
Well, you know, the thing that I learned about the musicians that I worked with is that they were ordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
That was the thing that impressed me the most. I was fortunate to be out with the Crusaders, being around them, because they maintained their Southern roots. Styx Hooper was a fisherman. I liked the fish.
Really?
Joe Sample was a hunter. Of course, he named an album The Hunter.
That's right.
At one point, but he was a hunter.
Okay.
So all of that was part of my Southern roots. So I'm saying now, these are great jazz icons, but they do a lot of the things that I like to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that supported me staying grounded.
Right.
You know, because in Hollywood, it's easy to get off the beaten path and get into a whole nother thing that has nothing to do with anything.
I hear you.
So, you know, starting out, these guys, music was their vocation, and then they had a life. And that kind of set in me staying grounded.
Awesome. Yeah, well, here's one thing I want to thank you for. A few years ago, I had the pleasure of performing in Los Angeles, and after the performance, I look up, and there you were, with that big smile and the big arms to embrace me. That's pretty cool. And through the years, I've seen that kind of support with many musicians at various conferences and whatnot. And I think what you're saying is it's because of other musicians who treated you the same way, you're doing the same thing.
That's my mission. I mean, there would be no me without those that put their hands out and embrace me.
Oh,
I would be in jail on drugs or something else.
Mm.
But because of music, my life changed and became a life.
Oh, wow.
You know, so I owe it to return this back to those that will receive.
Mm. Boy, lessons for us all. In terms of music, I'm not going to request anything. I'm going to let you pick whatever you want us to play for the listeners. I hear. So let's think of your early career. Your first recordings. What would you set up?
Well, my first recordings, my first record was with a local guy by the name of Harold Johnson Sextet.
Okay.
You would never be able to find that record.
Okay. We will look, though.
But my early recordings of merit, of note, mm-hmm. of heart, of creativity, of monumental signature would be the early George Duke MPS recordings. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of box sets and combinations. The first one was Faces and Reflection, then Feel, then The Aura Will Prevail, then I Love the Blues, She Heard My Cry. And then I think it was That's What She Said. I might be going a little out of order now, but the first four or five are all in order. Those were the recordings where I started to be me. Now, in the interim, I had recorded with Harold Land and Bobby Hutcherson, Hampton Hawes, Calvin Keyes, Michael Howell, Henry Franklin, and all of those guys. But the George Duke records were the first records where I was part of a group. And it started out a trio, and then it ended up George Duke and I, and then we started building around that foundation.
Okay.
And we started adding various bass players. It was through George Duke that my association with Alphonso Johnson started, which then gets us up to Weather Report.
Okay. Well, let's pick something from George Duke. What do you want to pick?
It's from The Aura Will Prevail.
Okay.
And it's called Dawn.
Dawn. Set us up. You be the DJ on this one. Go ahead.
Well, Dawn was, it was a record about the dawn, you know, but it was a record where we kind of was moving into the freedom of the 70s. A lot of people call that the fusion era. I just call it the 70s, and I call that the lost era of jazz. Hmm. Because at the same time, I was recording with one of my old schoolmates, Patrice Rushen.
Oh.
And she was making that transition, as we all were, from straight-ahead jazz to the new music that incorporated electronics, that incorporated the new rhythms, mm-hmm. that incorporated the new forms and the new harmonies. So with George Duke, we were starting to put that into works. It wasn't funk. It wasn't straight-ahead. Mm-hmm. But it was these creative, rhythmic, harmonic, new ways of playing the music.
Right. All right. Well, this is it. Let's play The Dawn.
Just Dawn.
Dawn. Here it is. Dawn in Dugo Chancellor with George Duke.
Thank you.
This is The Real Deal with Orbert Davis on 90.9 FM WDCB. And that was Dawn, George Duke, with my special guest today, Ndugul Chancellor, taking us back to his early recordings and bringing the funk into the jazz. We talked briefly about a project called The Meeting, which featured basically friends. I mean, you guys were hanging together, living this early stages of fusion. Patrice Rushen.
Ernie Watts.
Alfonso Johnson.
Well, that whole band started with a jazz festival. We were put together to play the Playboy Jazz Festival. And we were called Stars of the 80s.
Okay.
From that, we decided to become a band. Nice. And in 18 years, at that point, in 18 years, we only did two CDs.
Is that right?
Because the music was changing again, and they were going into the smooth jazz. So me being the creative rebel that I am, you know, having worked with Miles Davis, I don't like to succumb to just what everybody does. I like to do what I do.
Yeah.
So we were put together for that, and we stayed together and weathered the storm of the musical changes just to create some music that later on might become valid to the documentation of that period. That's why I call that the lost era of jazz, because there were so many different styles of music being created from scratch at that point, and a lot of it went unnoticed.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
You know, you talk about that era, and no one talks about Donald Byrd.
That's right. That's right. And probably because we developed such a marketing mindset. And I was going to ask you, just the whole question, I mean, it's a topic that becomes somewhat controversial in a way. Was smooth jazz a harmful concept, or did it do good for the music?
For jazz? No. No, not for jazz. Because smooth jazz started to pull too much from non-jazz elements.
Thank you.
And started to constrict what jazz is about. The key element of jazz is improvisation.
Right.
And when you take that spontaneity and you capsulize it and you bottle it and you water it down, that takes away from jazz. I mean, how can you have jazz when there's no interplay among the musicians?
Thank you.
I mean, when you got a drum machine playing, there's no interplay in the rhythm.
That's right.
So in one aspect, it introduced an audience that would not have been introduced to jazz, to a form of jazz.
Right.
However, it did not elevate their mindset
right.
to the whole culture of jazz.
Exactly.
And the whole thing of jazz, as it existed before, was based on you have choices.
Right.
You know, that's the whole thing of the 70s. You know, when I'm teaching and I'm trying to encourage guys to understand and embrace the music of the 70s, you know, I have to let them know, unless you have an affinity for avant-garde, you won't be able to play the music of the 70s, because there's so much freedom that exists in creating that music when it was created. You have to have that particular side of jazz in your makeup to even do that. It's not just a bunch of notes, a bunch of rhythms just played loud.
Right.
It's spontaneous creativity.
Mm-hmm.
So it hurt in a way.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think we are now?
We're in one of those nebulous periods where everyone's trying to find their niche and find their way. And I really kind of like this period, because this period is a period where musicians can once again be a part of shaping where the business of the music and where the audience is created.
Right.
You know, with the internet, with the cultures of world music, with musicians now doing their own projects without any corporate influence, it gives the creative artist that has a business sense a platform to do what they've always wanted to do and not complain about no one will embrace it.
Exactly.
Someone will embrace it.
Right. That's awesome. Oh, if you hear a pause, it's because it's all sinking in right here, because I'm one of those musicians. But I have to be radio host, so pick something else now. Pick something that inspires you. Let's play something.
That inspired me?
That inspires you, yeah. Let's say inspires you right now.
It inspired me back then, and it inspires me now.
Okay.
Anything from Miles at Fillmore, and I know you can't play a long deal of it, but if you play anything, just the intro to Friday Miles or Saturday Miles from Miles at Fillmore,
okay.
Even to date, that album, I have like 5 or 6 favorites. Uh-huh. These are the artists and the music that I have like 3 or 4 of the same CDs of. And whenever I need inspiration, that's where I go. I go to Miles at Fillmore. Mm-hmm. I go to Chick Corea, Tones for Jones Bones.
Yeah.
I go to Never Titi.
Mm.
I go to Milton Nascimento.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I have his whole collection. And, of course, Marvin Gaye, What's Going On. Those are like my most influential, inspirational projects ever.
Okay.
And then I have Eddie Harris, the electrifying Eddie Harris.
Oh, my goodness. Wow, this is school. I can't write so fast. But how about Miles Davis at the Fillmore playing Directions?
That would be great.
All right.
I know it's a long track, so you'll probably edit it down because it's a little lengthy.
Yeah.
But, you know, Jack DeJohnette was one of the first drummers I met playing the drums. I met Jack and Styx at the same jazz festival when I was 13 years old. I saw Buddy Rich, Jack DeJohnette, Styx Hooper, the Don Ellis Big Band that featured Steve Bohannon.
Ellis, that's a name we don't hear often.
That's right.
Oh, my goodness.
So I met those guys early on, and Jack happens to be one of my favorite drummers. My most influential drummer to me was Bruno Carr.
Who's Bruno?
Bruno played with Herbie Mann during its heyday, but he also came out of Ray Charles, Hank Crawford, and David Fathead Newman.
That makes sense. Okay.
That was like the guy that I copied because Bruno played Latin music with Herbie Mann. He swung and he did it all. He played funky and all of that. So that was one of my major influences.
Okay. Well, here's Directions. And if it seemed like it's getting long, we're just going to start talking a little bit over top of it and just let it become the soundtrack to our experience. Miles Davis, Directions from Live at the Fillmore. Inspiring, I should say, in Dougal Chancellor, right here in The Real Deal. We'll be right back.
The Miles at the Fillmore album really epitomizes what that era was about. Mm. They were funky. They were free. They were creating new sounds. Because on Miles at the Fillmore, he's got two. Let me qualify this
Go
CD.
Ahead. Break it
this
down.
This CD set up what all the jazz bands started to do from that point on.
Okay.
Two keyboard players, a percussionist. Jazz wasn't used to incorporating those elements prior to that point.
Mm-hmm.
You look at most bands now, there's two keyboard players.
Right.
You look at most bands now, there's a percussionist and a drummer.
That's right.
You know, all this was being started then. Yeah, we know Dizzy Gillespie and Chano Pozo did the Afro-Cuban thing mm-hmm. with Manteca and all of that. But now you have electronics
mm-hmm.
and percussion.
Mm-hmm.
And later, three guitars. Now, as a session player in Los Angeles, when we did sessions, we had two keyboard players,
mm-hmm.
three guitar players, drums, mm-hmm. percussion. That was a typical rhythm session.
Wow, and everybody had a part.
Everybody had a part.
Uh-huh.
Now, of course, we know James Brown operated that way.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so now you're starting to see how, you know, we started off talking about Quincy Jones
mm-hmm.
and the jazz and the commercial pop or whatever you want to call it. Now you're seeing how the jazz and all of that meld together initially anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Now the thing that most people don't realize is the musicians, the studio musicians that made all the records were jazz musicians.
Exactly.
So you always had a jazz tinge to every record because right. to create something on the spot and make it a hit required a creative mind.
Exactly.
Because you didn't have all day to sit up and milk something
right.
to try to make it.
Too expensive.
I mean, we were going in making records. We had 3 hours to cut two, three, four songs.
That's right.
So you had to zero in on a groove, a melody, and put it down.
Right.
So that's a jazz thing.
It is.
That's not a funk thing. That's not a rock. That's a jazz thing.
Yeah.
So when you look at what was happening in the studio and you look at what was happening with Miles Davis, they were all going together. And then the band started incorporating these things, not really giving credence to where it came from.
Mm. Wow. And then the rhythm section of Miles then become leaders in their own right, extending those possibilities.
Yeah, well, let's take the next band. See, I played with Miles in 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And that band featured Keith Jarrett, Gary Bartz, Michael Henderson, James M. Toomey, and Don Elias. So we had two percussionists.
Right.
The next band, when Al Foster, Reggie Lucas, Balakrishna, Bottle Roy, Pete Cozy. So now we have three guitar players, one playing an electric sitar. We have the meshing of the world music
yes.
with Bottle Roy Indian, playing the
yeah.
tabla.
Yeah.
So now you got the world music coming into jazz again. Of course, they're not giving Miles credit for any of this mm-hmm. because they're calling this the fusion era. And what when they called mm-hmm. it the fusion era, you notice I said
confusion.
Because they really wanted to confuse the minds of the people as to how much jazz this really was. And it was actually the new thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And people didn't want to embrace that and accept that.
Wow.
And I used to do lectures and seminars, and I'd say, if you take away all the instrumentation behind Miles Davis, you'll find that Miles Davis is still the Miles Davis that you love and admire and adore. Mm. You just have to get used to the new setting that's underneath.
Right, right, right. Because the mystique of his trumpet sound is still there.
Right.
And the creativity.
Yes.
Yeah, awesome. It's like an actor who's older playing a different role.
Right. He's still the same guy.
He's the same guy. Same yeah. artistic integrity.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. See, I told everybody this is going to be school. Man, I'm getting schooled. Wow. So a little bit more about being a studio musician. Like, what was a typical day like in terms of, did you know what was going to happen that day?
No. Being a studio musician was being a jazz musician. Mm-hmm. At that point, during the height of me doing sessions in Los Angeles, a typical day for me would be from 12 to 18 hours. Mm. And that might be one project or three different projects going from studio to studio. I would have a barrage of equipment sent to each studio. I never knew exactly what I would be doing.
Right.
And I remember explicitly the epitome of that is when we did the Frank Sinatra session for L.A. Is My Lady, we did not know it was a live video shoot as well.
I have that video.
Okay, and if you look at that video, I have on a pink polo shirt and a Rockwell overall.
Oh, no.
And they have me in the screen split with Frank Sinatra.
Oh, my goodness.
Because, you know, usually we went to the studio any way we wanted to go.
Exactly.
Because we were just recording.
That's right.
Well, that session taught me a lesson. Dress every time you go to play. Because at the same time, we'd be doing sessions for Japanese artists, uh-huh. and they'd have all these photographers there.
Exactly.
And so Swing Journal and all of these magazines from Japan would have pictures of us in the studio. So right. from that point, it took me back to the days of Duke Ellington and Cab Calloway and all of that, yeah. when you had to dress.
Yeah.
So I started, and Miles Davis was another one that always, he was a dresser.
Right.
You know, so that was a typical day in the studio was, well, who are we recording for? Well, I don't know. And you get there and it's like, well, this is for this movie or this is for this artist and so is going to be singing and it's going to be jazz, it's going to be rock, it's going to be funk. So you never knew.
Yeah.
So you had to wear different hats. Even in the course of a day, we would go over to Motown and play one kind of music and then we'd go over to Paramount and play for a film, which might be period pieces or anything of the sort.
Exactly.
So you always had to be on your P's and Q's, mm-hmm. and you always had to read a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes it would be 6 people, 4 people, and sometimes it would be 70 people
right.
in the studio.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, I miss those days. But anyway, so was there at any time a project that while you were recording it, you said, this is it, or this is a big hit, or?
Michael Jackson was probably the biggest. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, I ghost for, and a lot of people in the public never knew some of these things. But as a session player, we ghost for a lot of bands. So before the demise of the Commodores, I ghost on a lot of their records.
Oh.
And before Lionel broke away, you could hear Lionel breaking away because the session musicians started to ghost for were the ballads and the things that created a different sound for Lionel.
Right.
And we dovetail right out of that into recording for Lionel.
That, yeah.
Now, the thing about Lionel has a jazz thing to himself as well.
Alto saxophone?
Well, we cut some jazz with Lionel back
right?
in the day.
Oh, my goodness.
Motown never allowed it to come out. It's probably in the deep vault.
locked up somewhere.
Yeah, it's probably locked up where it'll never come out. But those were the first albums where we knew that, or we felt that, some groundwork was being laid. You know, during the period where he was doing Lady and all of those songs.
Three times
he was,
Lady.
Yeah, he was getting into this whole ballad thing.
Right.
And he's in that country. I'm trying to remember the song where he had that country voice.
Sail On.
Sail On.
Right, right.
Yes. Yeah. Those were the beginnings of, well, this is a new thing as well.
Right.
So Lionel then connected us all with Kenny Rogers.
That's right. lady.
We started recording records for Kenny Rogers.
Is that right?
Now, I'll tell you a funny story about that is back then, country music was still country music.
Mm-hmm.
And there weren't a lot of blacks out on the road during country music. The only black that was touring in country music was Willie Weeks.
Oh, I think it was Charlie Pride.
No, well, Charlie Pride was Charlie Pride.
Yeah, right.
But Willie Weeks was the only black musician that was touring.
Oh, I see.
With any country act at that point.
Right.
Willie Weeks was really smart. He had just left the Doobie Brothers, and he moved to Nashville. And Wynonna and Naomi and that whole circle embraced him. You know, because Willie came out of Donny Hathaway.
Yeah.
And then ended up with the Doobie Brothers. And then he moved down there, and he was one of the first.
Okay.
And he was one of the only blacks doing touring with these country acts.
Okay.
Now, a lot of us were recording the music in L.A., but we couldn't tour. Because I remember we were doing a Kenny Rogers session one day, and this guitar player, who will remain nameless, went right up to Kenny Rogers and said, Mr. Rogers, how come you never ask us to go on tour? And he was innocent about it because he grew up in California. He wasn't from the South or anything like that, so he didn't know anything about that. And Kenny Rogers just told him, he said, well, my fans are not ready to see you guys on stage with me. Now, we were cutting the records, but America wasn't ready to see a new face or a new color in country music.
Wow. And this is the 80s, right?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. Okay. The Gambler.
It's
the Gambler.
Know when to fold them.
You know, so, you know, being a studio musician, a lot of times we were actually the chameleons because we were cutting music across all color lines.
Yes.
In fact, you may remember when one of the studio drummers, Paul Humphreys, ended up playing the Lawrence Welk show.
That's right.
You know, so, and you had Earl Palmer doing Percy Faith and people like that. So we were already crossing the color lines, but there were only a select few that were doing it, but it wasn't promoted out in the medium and the masses.
Right.
So getting back to where we were, you know, with Lionel, we started doing these other kinds of recordings, and that was like one of the first commercially successful new things that I was involved with. Before, you played a record, it was a hit. It was just a hit, but it was an R&B hit,
right,
or it was a pop hit, depending on what it was.
Right.
Lionel started to cross over.
Right.
And then Kenny, you know, after working with Lionel, Lionel brought us into Kenny Rogers.
Yeah.
Those things started to cross over.
Exactly.
So by the time we got to Michael Jackson, the color line was broken.
Mm.
It was just, we're going to get the best musicians we can get,
right,
and we're going to record, and we're going to make music. So then it's like, I'm already part of something successful.
Right. Awesome. Okay, next question. When are you going to write the book?
I've been waiting to write the book
because
it'll be quite interesting. And, you know, I always felt like I didn't have a story to tell because I was young, but I'm now just starting to realize that there is a story to tell in there. So I do need to start on that.
I think so.
Soon.
Yeah, there's so many connections, especially where we are now, where we're experiencing a renaissance, even in popular music, where there's an emphasis on reaching back, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, so we should, yeah. Okay, I'm going to keep my eye on you and keep reminding you, where's my book?
Okay, all right.
Let's get back to some music. We're almost done with time. Boy, time is just flying by. So we're going to call this part one. This is our part one meeting. We got to do this again. Let's close out with, again, something of your choice.
Something of my choice. Well, we haven't played and we haven't mentioned Santana. We haven't mentioned Weather Report.
Oh, my goodness.
We haven't mentioned Herbie Hancock. Well, we mentioned Herbie Hancock,
yeah,
but we hadn't talked about any of the records. And these are the jazz milestone records for me. We haven't talked about any of the Ramsey Lewis records, After the Sun Goddess. We haven't talked about Stanley Turrentine. We haven't talked about Fuse One.
Okay, part five. The real deal with Tugel Chancellor, part five.
Well, let's do some Herbie Hancock.
Herbie Hancock.
My favorite piano player.
All right. And this is something you've recorded.
Yeah, let's do I Thought It Was You.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. Herbie Hancock, I Thought It Was You. This is from Sunlight?
See? Yes.
From Sunlight. right here on The Real Deal. And actually, we're going to close off with this. So before we go, I want to give a very special thank you to Ndugu Tansler for stopping by at The Real Deal with Orbert Davis. And he will be back, I promise. Take care, man. We'll see you.
Thank you.
I'm gonna go to the bathroom.